Welcome to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hulings Fund for Visual Artists. The Clark Hulings Fund exists to provide training, introductions, and funding for working artists to turn working artists into thriving artists. Our guest today is Jim Grace. Jim is an attorney for the arts and executive director of the Arts and Business Council of Greater Boston. One of their major programs is Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts of Massachusetts, which does free legal services for the arts, including seminars on legal topics. Jim is also co-author of the Joan Mitchell Foundation's workbook on estate planning for artists. Jim, can you take a minute to just tell us a little bit about your background and what you do?
Sure. Thanks very much for having me on the program today. I really appreciate it. So I run the Arts and Business Council of Greater Boston, as you said, and our mission really is to provide kind of business services, the business side of being a working artist or arts organization. And we do that through a series of different programs that have kind of grown over the years, Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts being one of the main ones. The other programs that we have are Business on Board, which is training and placing business people on arts organization boards, which is a great program that's both here and then also all around the country through Americans for the Arts, Arts and Business Council. And we also have a series, we do about 40 workshops a year on the business side of being an artist through different fellowships and different programs that we offer locally. We also are a partner of Space Finder, which is a Fractured Atlas product for kind of the Uber of performance space, and we're the local partner in New England. We have exhibition programs. We have this legacy program, which we'll talk more about today. And then we also have a small fiscal sponsorship program for local public artists in our area as well. So it's a different programs, but the main goal is really similar to yours, which is to support artists and empower them to meet their own goals.
I love that point about placing business people on the boards of arts organizations. Increasingly, I think people are becoming aware, artists especially, becoming aware that what they do is a professionalized activity, that there are some needed business skills, some much-needed business training. And, of course, that dovetails really well with the mission of the Clark Hulings Fund, which is all about equipping working artists. Maybe you could also mention a little bit about the work you've done with the Joan Mitchell Foundation.
Yeah, that's been a wonderful partnership. So the Joan Mitchell Foundation has, and has for many years, they have a wonderful program called CALL, which is Creating a Lasting Legacy. And that program is really focused on getting artists prepared for their estates, getting them prepared, you know, as working artists, and really investing in them. And they've had partnerships with different artists and arts organizations around the country. And then at one point it came to the idea of there's a lot of materials and information out there, but let's do one that is kind of very artist-centric and really kind of demystifies, you know, part of this process. So we work with them to create this workbook, and it's for free, and it's on their website. So that's one of our goals, is to get this information out there. And that's why I'm very happy to talk with you all today and hopefully reach some more artists on this topic.
Well, so I'm going to ask you a very loaded question. For an attorney that, you know, specializes in estate planning, this one should be just the wide open, you know, the landscape is yours. So tell us about the importance of estate planning for visual artists.
Yeah, this is, so my background in this, so about, I would say almost 18 or 20 years ago now, you know, in New York, they had a program called the SAFE program. So it was primarily during the beginnings of the AIDS epidemic. There was a lot of artists in New York that were passing away, and they didn't really have estates at that time. Obviously, you couldn't get married at that time if you were a same-sex couple. So there's all these issues coming up. So that's the first time I really became aware of the issue. And then really over all those years, we would, through the VLA, get requests, and we would host these workshops, and no one would come. I literally mean we would have regular workshops, and I think of estate planning in general, never mind for artists, it's kind of like the Brussels sprouts of legal services. You know, no one really wants to talk about death, family, money, and taxes, never mind separately, but you put them all together, and it's a tough conversation. It's a tough sell to get people to focus on it. So we've been particularly focused on how do we do that in a way that's approachable? How do we get people to get proactive about this and not necessarily reactive? So that's really my background. It's been a many year process of kind of figuring out how best to talk about this, engage people, and then to help people.
Well, so I'm going to ask you some questions. You know, obviously every estate plan is unique to the individual artist. What they need and how they're going to structure it is based on a lot of personal decisions. But I want to ask you about some individual aspects that may go into maybe core ingredients in an estate plan. So let's start with healthcare proxy, living will, because a lot of people don't immediately, you know, they associate an estate plan, oh, that's having a will, I have a will, I created one of those kits, you know, whatever. But I think a lot of people don't immediately associate it with healthcare and those decisions. And you brought up the SAFE program, which takes us right there. So can you talk a little bit about the kinds of decisions that artists need to make around healthcare and living will as, and healthcare proxies as part of their estate plan?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is you know, part of the topic where it really applies to everybody. This isn't really an artist-specific issue, and we'll get to some more of those probably later on. But, you know, this is just being, you know, recognizing that if you were ever in an accident or you no longer have the capacity to make decisions, how would you want those decisions to go, and who would you want to make those decisions, you know, for you? And then also making it somewhat convenient for those folks so that, you know, they don't have to go scrambling around. And everyone has heard stories in the news, you know, famous stories in the news where people get caught between battles between family members and all those horrible things that can happen in a time of crisis. So, you know, this is that idea is, you know, who do you want to have make those really hard decisions, and what are they in advance so that you can let those know, let those be known. And that's what those two documents do. They allow for those types of decisions to be made.
Do you think a lot of artists, do you think artists in general know what a healthcare proxy is or what a living will really does? Is that something that that still needs to be a point of education for a lot of artists?
Yeah, I do. I think it's a point of education for a lot of folks. And that's one of the, that's the other reason for kind of doing this work, is so that then the artist or the couple, or, you know, for their kids or for their friends, they go talk to a professional estate planning lawyer, and they go better prepared. I mean, one of the goals of this is to be a good client. You know, we know that we're not going to get everyone perfectly there, but if we can just get them at the table and get them in the chair to have a conversation with somebody who can help them, then, like you said, then everyone's a little different. They're going to ask questions. It's going to evolve. I just want to get people in the chair so that they can have these conversations, and then get some help to actually, you know, get this stuff buttoned up a little bit more.
Well, let's drill down a little bit. So in what ways might a healthcare proxy or a living will help an artist with going into the future? You know, it bring me up to speed too, in terms of, you know, what decisions am I really making when I talk about healthcare proxies and living wills?
Yeah, you're making a decision of whether you want, you know, what extent you want to be saved, and who's going to make the decision ultimately to turn off any respirator, turn off, you know, any machine, depending on your level of capacity. So it's the ultimate decision, you know, really. It's who gets to make the decision, and how much work do you want done on you to keep you alive, and depending on what state you're in. That's usually when it comes up, or it might come up if it's like a power of attorney question, if you're incapacitated and need just the business of being a person done. So this is, you know, these are the ultimate types of decisions sometimes, and that's definitely one of the purposes of those two types of documents.
Well, you mentioned power of attorney, and, you know, a lot of visual artists have somebody, some don't, but have somebody that is managing the business end of their work, you know, taking care of gallery contracts, et cetera. Is this something that if you don't have a power of attorney on file, you haven't created something, that should you become incapacitated, there are risks to that person still maintaining that role if they're not a spouse or if there's not already some pre-existing agreement? Are there things here that artists should really be concerned about that would lead them to take action to get a power of attorney?
Well, it depends. You know, it really depends on the situation. And like you say, if they're married, if they have, you know, children, adult children that can take stuff, if they have business relationships, existing lawyers, you know, that one is definitely, it depends. But I think the more, it's part of a total package of different components of a good, healthy estate plan, and the power of attorney is one of those. But usually they're only for a particular purpose or a particular time. So that would be, it really would depend on the situation. But it is a tool to allow others to act on your behalf.
Yeah, so if you are incapacitated, whether it's an accident or you're going into surgery or whatever it is, you know, somebody has to manage your business and have the rights to cash the checks and pay the bills and do the things that are necessary that, you know, you might be signing some of those checks if your arm works, but not if it doesn't.
Yeah, exactly. That is the role of a power of attorney. They can either be very specific to a situation or very broad powers, depending on, like you say, your level of capacity. But it is kind of that tool so that you can keep on with the business of living. And yes, it is part of a overall plan. Absolutely.
Well, let's go back to this issue also of, you know, people associate estate planning with just getting a will. But, you know, I think some of the big things are trusts as well. And I would venture to say a lot of us don't really understand the difference between a will and a trust or even what a trust really is. Can you shed some light?
Yeah, sure. And let me take this on a little bit of a different direction in some ways, because I think when I start talking to people, I don't usually start with, more of the documents themselves. I think the approach I think to demystify this is really to start with what is someone's legacy? How do they want to define legacy? How do they want to, especially for a working artist that might have acquired a ton of work over the years, you know, what are their goals and how do they want, you know, these series of documents to really help them kind of translate their goals, and what kind of team do they need of people, and what kind of questions they have to ask themselves in order to get to that idea of legacy. And that conversation could take a long time. It's a heady question to ask somebody, and it is a process. So that's usually where I start. And then you can get into these other documents like trusts and, wills and healthcare proxies, power of attorneys, to see if those are appropriate tools to meet those goals. And they may or may not.
Yeah, so you're saying the goals are first, the tools are second, and the tools are really just options for achieving those goals. I think
absolutely, yeah.
I think knowing though some of the range of options is useful, but I'd like to keep tying them back to, you know, what somebody's goals might be, because, you know, the goals are different for every artist. So how can we think
right.
about sort of our available options in terms of what, you know, you might have this goal, these available options, and then what tool might satisfy it? Artist Endowed Foundation. This is a thing where, you know, part of your legacy, if you're a successful working artist, might be to endow a foundation. So how does that work? What might that satisfy in terms of an overall charitable goal? What other options are there, and what tools might we use?
Yeah, and there's been a lot of research on this. There's actually a great report that was published a few years back that talked all about this, and we can send a link to you all to put this on your blog or your website, because it's a great research on artists and endowed foundations and kind of the pros and cons and different aspects to them. But to kind of boil it down, I would say there are just very few working artists today that probably could justify it from the legal, accounting, financial commitment, setting up a nonprofit for an artist endowed foundation. You would have to be at a level where you are both the work itself was at a particular value, and there was enough funds to support it. You would have that would be kind of a top tier solution, you know, for a working artist today, and probably one that would not be the most appropriate option for most artists in this country right now. That's kind of like the major leagues.
The Joan Mitchell Foundation is an artist endowed nonprofit as well.
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. Same with Warhol and many others.
Exactly. That takes some serious funds, some serious success there.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's my point. I mean, you know, that is a major institution in that way. And they have a ton of different actual programming and boards. I mean, it is a functioning operating foundation with a lot of different programs and curatorial and research and programs with kids and national programs like the CALL program. So, you know, that's the, when I think about a Artist Endowed Foundation doing programming and work and with a substantial body of work, that would be what I would consider an example of a really good Artist Endowed Foundation. But if you were a working artist and you had a lot of work, that probably wouldn't be what I would suggest as a tool for you. and like I say, there's a lot of good materials and research on this, then you might get into other tools like trust, or you could get into, depending on how, you know, gifting it, you know, other ways that might meet your goals, whether that be just preservation of the work, or are you really trying to create separate programs that support you know, individual artists, arts organizations, or some other cause that you believe in? That's one of the key differences. You know, is it just about preserving and protecting the work, or is it really about establishing an entity or organization to do good work, however you define that to be?
Yeah, so it takes you back to your goals, your sense of mission. You know, if it's just a bequest of your work,
exactly.
There are things you can do with that that are charitable, that serve your mission without creating an organization. There are organizations that can benefit. And then, but if it is primarily about mission, I'm sure there are some other options that aren't as involved as, say, an artist endowed foundation.
Yeah, for example, we worked with an artist who really, his name is Walter Feldman, wonderful artist, and he really wanted to support individual artists as part of his legacy. And one of his, you know, turning points in his career when he had a major solo show in New York back in the 60s. And, you know, to him, that was a big moment in his career. So he created a program with us called the Walter Feldman Solo Exhibition Program, where, you know, we are putting the business skills and all the business support around someone's first solo exhibition. And for him, that was just a creative way for him to define legacy. And I think it's a good example of how artists can get very creative about, you know, what that means to them, and then to partner with, you know, organizations to help them execute that. You know, that wasn't an artist endowed foundation. You know, that was with collaborating with an arts organization and then, you know, providing specific, you know, support to make it happen. So this is, and you know, artists are some of the most creative people I've ever met, obviously, and I always encourage them to be creative about how they want to think about legacy and then how they want to make that happen in a way that is reasonable and effective and efficient. And that's why I always start with what your goals are and then think about what are the different tools out there and not let the tail wag the dog. I find that too often it's the entity choice, or it's somebody told me once my cousin's aunt's brother said I should do this, when really that could have been a very specific, you know, particular, you know, goal for somebody else. But really kind of starting at that 30,000 and then working your way down to seeing how to truly kind of effectuate that is, I think, a healthy process.
I think that phenomenon of the tail wagging the dog, it's very common with people that achieve celebrity. You know, someone will say, well, I want to feed starving kids in Africa, and so I'm going to create a foundation. And a lot of organizations rally around that and say, hey, wait a minute, there's already a lot of organizations on the ground doing this. So there are plenty of ways that you as a celebrity can lend your status and your financial support to something that's already working and established, rather than spend it all building something new.
Yeah, that's a great point. And that's part of one of the things that people have to recognize about, you know, anytime you're creating this new entity, whether it be an artist endowed foundation or you're setting up even a simple trust, you know, each of these, there are pros and cons, and they're neither good nor bad. It's just whether or not they are a good match with your resources, your time, your expertise, your funds, how long you want this to last, you know, versus a short-term solution over a long period of time. Again, no right or wrong, but I always try to help people get informed. And I think that's one of the goals of Joe Mitchell and one of the goals of the workbook and their other workbooks that they have. And then a lot of other great organizations, the Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts Network, which is about 30 other Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts programs of all different sizes around the country. All those programs around the country are just like us. They have they do have a focus on estate planning, and they do have oftentimes lawyers that are local that will help artists. So this isn't, that's what's good about this conversation. It's not really about us. It's about a conversation that we want to have more of, and we want people to go to their local VLAs or go to their local arts organizations and get help and begin to have these conversations, so they're better prepared.
So let me ask you another, again, this may be at the risk of it being more of a tools and options-based conversation. I'm going to rely on you to take us back a step toward what possible goals are there. What can you tell us about lifetime gifts and testamentary gifts and other types of gifts that artists might be considering?
Yeah, that would go to the, let's just maybe give an example where, let's say someone's been working for many years and they have, you know, let's say 500 pieces in their, you know, personal collection of their work. So what, so if I were to, you know, if I, let's say, you know, I'm having a conversation with you and you're the working artist and you have these 500 pieces, you know, we're going to have a conversation about what to do with those pieces. You know, what do you want to do with those pieces? Some of them might be for family, some might be for friends, some might be promised to institutions. You might have a working gallery for you, and they might have a particular line of work that they're interested in selling for you over time. So there's going to be a breakdown of that 500 pieces and what you want to do with it. So part of that solution might be some of those works might be donated. There's wonderful programs like the Art Connection around the country where visual artists donate work, and then those works end up getting donated to local nonprofits in the area, and they get to be shown and enjoyed and it, you know, just to be appreciated. So part of it might be the gifting away of it, and some of it might be for sale, some of it might be for exhibition or for being acquired by some collecting institution, and that's part of the plan. And that's just one other tool, is that idea of gifting away the work.
I imagine this applies equally then to collectors, not just the artists themselves, you know, because collectors have often quite an inventory.
Absolutely. Yeah, but in some ways the collector, it's harder and easier for the collector, because unless the collector has collected all of one artist, they often have, you know, multiple artists. But they do have some of the similar problems of, you know, insurance and storage and conservation, and then, you know, what's going to happen with the work? Is it going to be gifted to a series of collecting institutions, passed down to their heirs, given away as gifts? So they have a similar challenges in some ways. It's just a problem of having, if you have 500 of the work of your, you know, your work or of the same artist, it just becomes an extra challenge of, you know, what to do with it all. And not all of it necessarily might be being collected now. It might be collected in the future. It might not really have a secondary market where you just couldn't call up your local auctioneer and to put it out there and have a market for it in that way, where some other kind of more name brand artist might have that ability to do that. So it really depends. And I do think it does go back to what your goals are and then in what your time frame is.
There's no real substitute. You know, it's not really on the artist to or the collector to sit down and answer all of these questions by oneself. That ultimately this is the reason for consulting an attorney and doing a lot of planning. And this is really the reason why these volunteer legal services organizations for the arts exist. So let's kind of shift into another segment of the show where we're talking about some of the issues that arise in that decision making process. So, for instance, valuation of your art. I mean, it seems to me a key issue. You've got, it's not as simple as, well, these are the price stickers that we put on the back, but there are unfinished works in your inventory. There are questions of whether you've had a formal appraisal of the work in the past. What kinds of things do artists and collectors need to think about when it comes to valuing the art that's going to be distributed as part of their estate plan?
Yeah, right. I think the main point, I'll add, you know, the lawyers that represent artists as well in that catch-all. I think the first thing is that there is no one price, like you said. If we go back to our example of the 500 pieces, which isn't a crazy number. It could be, you know, it could be 1,500, could be, you know, a couple thousand, depending on the type of work and the person over time. So there's going to be different values, and it's a little bit of a planning. It's also a tax question. You know, if there is a subset of the work that has acquired a lot of value, there could be a real tax consequence that the lawyer who's doing your estate plan really should know about, because otherwise, all of a sudden, if that work were to become very valuable at the time of your death, you might have you know, tax liabilities over time. So, you know, that's something to think about. And that's something to plan for. That's why it's really important for especially the collector, who often are, you know, pretty sophisticated about these things, that they have thought about that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that can be an unintended consequence is passing on a tax liability. You know, that, and I'm sure there are ways around that. Are there not in the planning that I don't mean to avoid all taxation, obviously, but I mean, I think there are decisions you can make that minimize the negative potential tax consequences versus decisions mostly around neglecting your estate plan that create, I think it's neglecting your estate plan that creates the biggest potential tax consequence.
Absolutely, especially if there's a lot of value. Now, if the average person has most of their estate plan, usually most of their estate is the value of their house, let's say. You know, so that's for their retirement plans or other things. So, you know, if a working artist doesn't have a lot of assets, then it's unlikely that the total value of their art is probably going to kick them into a tax consequence. But it's not just them; their partner, or they might have other assets or inheritance over time. You know, it's not always just about the art; it's the total picture that their representative is going to look at. I agree, we hate to have the oversight of not thinking about their artwork tip them into a place where it's not necessarily a consequence to the future, it's a consequence right then. You know, they're going to have to pay the tax then, it's not a future tax, and what that could do to an estate. So it's just, again, it just goes back to that idea of each one's a little different, but as long as they're having an informed conversation and they know enough, both the lawyer knows enough to ask, and then the artist knows enough to bring this up as a conversation and to put it in the documents, it just makes it better. It just helps it avoid mistakes and future problems.
You know, I don't think it can be emphasized enough. I mean, the last thing you want to have happen is that your works are now being sold off at the time of your death in order to pay a tax consequence. For expedient reasons, maybe to different people than you would have sold them for, maybe at different prices, maybe with a different, maybe they're not, you know, it may not be what you want, versus giving somebody actual, it's one thing to give somebody work that you've done. It's another to give them true control of the work, which means I don't have to sell this just to pay the estate costs and tax bills. This was an issue. I mean, this happens all the time. And I think sometimes we can put our heads in the sand and not see what we're really seeing when we see big stories in the news, like when James Gandolfini died, the actor. There was a huge row over his estate because he simply had not done any proper estate planning. And so consequently, it was unclear not only who would get it, but there were major liabilities to take care of first that dramatically reduced the options for the people that did receive the estate and also reduced the value and size of the estate quite significantly. And then just the fighting itself is probably not something that an artist is intending to create if there are multiple stakeholders that might be recipients. So when we see something like that in the news, it should be like a wake-up call that, hey, we need to be planning our estate properly. And I think if we're emphasizing that 500 works example, I don't think that's anywhere near out of the range of the average working artist. And then they do have other assets, even if an artist were to say, well, I'm not sure the total value of my existing collection on hand is worth doing something with, you do have to take into account the total value of your estate. So that includes the art, it includes your house, it includes potentially your studio, it includes potentially some rights that you may have acquired for reuse of your works that you have sold or licensed or you're getting some kind of royalty payments on, etc. Wouldn't you concur that this is a big deal? Regardless of whether you consider yourself affluent or not, that we should be sort of paying attention to the negative impact of not doing something, of like your health. Literally, if you don't have action, your financial health for the next person is really at risk.
Yeah, I totally agree, and I think to humanize it, when we talk with folks, and I know the other VLAs and the Joan Mitchell, it's really also about the people. Who are people that are next, the people that you're leaving behind, and there's just a ton of work to be an executor or to deal with all these issues anyway, never mind that of a working artist. So I always say, if you really don't like your family, then definitely don't prepare. You know what I mean? Like, I do the double negative. Like, if you really, really despise everyone in your life, make them the executor. Because it's hard. It's hard on people. Never mind losing you, but then having all these other issues. So we can guilt people into this for other reasons, because they might say, look, whatever happens, happens. If the works get thrown out or whatever, I don't really care. Okay. But if you really press people, usually that's not really what they want to have happen. And they really want to make sure that they're not being a burden to their family. And so I usually try to stick with, let's just try to do some simple things so you're not a burden, you know, to the people who are trying to kind of wrap up your affairs. And that's where most people kind of come at it. And they can do simple things like we're talking about that make that a little easier.
I think what you're saying is it's okay to suffer for your art. Just don't make other people suffer for your art.
Well, yeah, make them suffer a little, but, you know, maybe not that.
That's right. I don't know too many artists that are 100% in sync with the rest of their family.
Right. So there may be a little payback there. Yeah, sure. But you did raise an interesting point about, you know, let's go back to the 500 again, which I agree. That's why I kind of kept it low only for that purpose. But, you know, even within the 500, there's probably a category of works that a working artist wouldn't want to have destroyed. You know, so even in the simplest ways, you know, there is that idea. You know, what do you want to survive? What don't you want to survive? And some of them people will, and some of them people won't. And it's good to know. And the other point that comes up, which we've seen a number of times, let's say I walk into your studio with 500 pieces. There is no way I'm going to be able to tell which ones are unfinished, finished. You know, maybe if they're signed, I could possibly say, or maybe you've kept your inventory, which we should talk about definitely. Many artists collect the work of their peers and friends. So of the 500, there might be 50 that have been collected by other people, you know, over the years. And how am I going to know who they are? And it's very possible some of those pieces, if the artist has been around for a while, some of those pieces might be as valuable or more valuable than their works, which I have definitely seen, you know, happen over time. So it goes back to, what do you want? What does your inventory look like? It doesn't have to be crazy complicated, but nobody is going to know more than you, especially when they walk into the typical artist studio.
Those are great questions. You know, what happens to your unfinished work? What happens to your collection of fellow artists? What about, let's dig into this more in this area of issues to consider. What about representation? You know, most artists are represented by someone, either an agent, there's a gallery, a dealer, and then there are issues with document archives, like, you know, where do you keep your copies of your contracts, your image licenses, releases, you know, gallery consignment agreements, things like that. What do artists need to think about in terms of the human representation that they've selected, and the documentation for all of that when they're planning their estate?
Yeah, and also to plug another Joan Mitchell, you know, part of the call program, is they have separate workbooks just on this point of kind of inventorying and this idea of kind of the professional person who can help artists, you know, get organized. And there's all kinds of software programs out there. There's kind of more higher-end ones that galleries use, and they have, you know, versions for artists, but they can be expensive. There's a program out of Colorado called GIST, Get Your Shit Together. They have a software program that helps artists kind of organize. But the key is organization. You know, it is, as the work is being, you know, either sold or if it's an inventory, you know, even the most simple thing, a photograph tied to a name and a date and a, you know, and a size, so that at the end of the day you have a working inventory, that is like very key. And I would say most artists don't do it. And again, most artists actually aren't represented, or if they are, they're represented kind of sporadically over a career, and maybe not like a consistency where you would get some of the support. So it's a huge issue, and it's something that maybe younger artists will be better at because they're more tech savvy and they're going to be kind of cataloging as they go. But it's an open issue, and it's one that's super important.
Well, and I'll go ahead and mention another tool, you know, that we at the Clark Hewlings Fund provide a tool called Artwork Archive. And we actually give people a 20% discount on their subscription for life. And, you know, the idea is that you should have an inventory, whether you're a collector or an artist. You should have an inventory. You should have also a way of monitoring your sales and invoices, potentially even sharing some of your collection or your work online in a social way, because it's not everyone wants to just sort of keep it secret in their closet. You know, we want to track the things that we've sold. We want to track the things that we've exhibited. We want to be able to assign statuses, but also there's this social aspect. So for those that are interested in a tool like that, you can actually visit the Clark Hewlings Fund website, clarkhewlingsfund.org, And just either go to the previous September 8th episode of our blog, our podcast on Artwork Archive, or look for the Artwork Archive page and access this tool. So it's a really valuable solution to some of what you've been talking about. There's also, there are also issues of how we take care of the estate during the estate distribution process, which isn't usually instantaneous. And then even afterwards, so there is storage of the art, there's maintenance of the art, you know, so that it's stored at the right temperature or stored in the right kind of environment. You can't just throw them in an unair-conditioned attic for storage for a while we sort of clean out the house. This stuff has to be properly cared for, distributed, and conserved, and there's some knowledge needed there, there's potentially some costs, and then on top of that, it's not even just the art, but there is some value, potentially large value in some cases, for consideration for distribution of the supplies. You know, more than just the art, the output, but what about all the tools, et cetera? Some people have an incredible amount invested in their tool set. So what insights do you have into what do we do about the maintenance and storage and the conservation aspect of it and those additional things that surround the practice of being an artist that aren't the art?
Yeah, and so one of my former board chairs, every time I would call him, and I say this story often, every time I would call him, he would answer the phone and know it was me, and he would say, "The answer is money, what's the question?" And he would say it super fast, you know, say, "The answer is money, what's the question?" You know, and so, you know, to everything you just said, part of the answer is money. You know, it is part of the answer to the question, which is, you know, let's say, for example, you have a separate studio and it's outside of your home, because you make a good point. If the studio is in your home and then the home is being sold, that kind of expedites the process maybe much quicker than you'd want if you have all these other kind of things you have to do. So, but let's say, for example, your studio is outside the home, a separate studio. So just even, you know, in your planning, if you put in, you know, 12 months of rent, let's say, that so the rent could be paid and that somebody could have access to it, and then we take the pressure off what to do with the work. It might be your gallery, your manager, your family, your partner, you know, would have access to it and have ability to not make quick decisions. So that's a simple solution, and that then you could ensure the work, because it's in a gallery, you know, it's in a separate space. It hopefully that space is the proper climate, or you could, you know, spend some money to make it at least not bad. So that's a really simple solution if you have a, you know, external studio. If it's in your house, though, then you'd have to plan. Again, but the answer is still money. You'd have to be able to put some money aside to have it go into proper storage. And then, it might just be for a year as the estate works out. Then you're going to have your family and friends and your collecting institutions or your folks who are giving it away to you, or as it gets, whatever happens to it, based on your wishes, then there's time. You know, so time, money gives you time, and planning gives you, you know, less opportunities for mistakes and gives your team more options.
There are some other issues as well around distributing the art that need to be solved in some cases, like approval from a donee organization. So, you know, you might make the mistake of thinking that, well, I can bequeath this art to an organization and that's it, I'm done. But you kind of have to get their approval and work that into the estate plan as well. And then occasionally there are issues of rights when there's joint, or this may apply less frequently to visual artists, but joint authorship or joint multiple creators in a given artwork. Especially in an art installation, oftentimes multiple visual collaborators will work together. So what issues surround that do you see?
Well, those are all amazingly great points. And you are kind of you're just touching on the whole idea of copyright, which we can definitely get to, and how that plays into this conversation. Because one of your first questions was, why is it so important? And one of the answers to that is because copyright exists, and copyright is your life plus 70 years. So instantly we're talking about property that's going to last, you know, past your lifetime. So to your point, it just goes back to planning, and it goes back to kind of what your goals are. But those are all great points, and everyone's going to have a different answer to those questions. Yeah. So just like a two second primer. So copyright is the protection of a creative expression or an expression in a fixed format. So if I were to right now take a piece of paper and draw on it, and my expression is, if it's an original expression and I'm fixing it in a piece of paper. So, you know, think of all the visual artists that are listening to this, you know, as they do their work is protected by copyright automatically. You don't have to put a C on it. You don't have to register it, although we recommend you are registering work that goes out into, you know, into the big bad world. But, you know, once you have that right, it's a property right, no different than a right that you have in your car or your house. They're just different types of property. And copyright is one example of intellectual property. It's copyright, trademark, and patents. So copyright being that, that property right in an expression, that creative expression, then just by the fact that it lasts for the life of the creator plus 70 years means you have 70 years of potential property rights. That's a long time. That's multiple generations. Now, it might not be needed. You might, you know, you might get rid of it, or it might necessarily not have a lot of value, but it's like a car that, it's like a car you buy that you own for 70 years after you die. You know, like, what are you going to do with the car? It's the same stuff, you know. You have to think about it in terms of a property right. So in your will or in your estate plan, when you give the property, when you give the physical artwork, are you giving the copyright to that same person or to that entity, or are you keeping that copyright back for some other purpose? And you have to really think about it like two different types of property, you know, really in the same thing. And that confuses people, and it confuses lawyers, and it confuses artists. And a lot of the estate plans that we see, they don't adequately deal with this idea of the intellectual property rights of an artist when they pass away. And it's a problem. So it's one of our goals and all the other VLAs around the country and the Joan Mitchell Foundation to, and other groups. You know, Columbia Law School has a program, and New York Volunteers for the Arts works with them on these issues too, and there's different books on this. So this is not just us. But it's an issue, and that's why it's an issue, because it lasts so long.
The Arts and Business Council's range includes a lot of these issues, publishing law, public art, you mentioned copyright, of course, and trademark, nonprofit, incorporation and mergers, negotiation training, artwork, artist workspace, nonprofit board legal issues. There's really a lot to consider. I want to sort of bring that around to just a quick question about the Arts and Business Council in Boston. So you created a shared workspace, or your organization created a shared workspace for several organizations in Boston. Is this a co-working space? Is this a maker space? And then how has this space created opportunities for collaboration that you wouldn't have had, or interesting dynamics that you might not have experienced if you hadn't done it this way?
Yeah, no, it's been a really great experience. So there's an artist-owned building in Boston called Midway Studios, and they were wonderful to lease to us a space on the first floor. So we're in an artist building. It looks like an artist building. It's great. And so when we were offered the space, we invited three other art service organizations to join us to kind of create this shared office, shared space environment, which has been great. So it's Arts and Business Council and its programs. It's Mass Creative, which is a statewide advocacy organization supporting the arts. And Stage Source, which is supports a theater membership organization supporting individual actors and theater producers and theater companies. So I think they have like 1,800 actors and about 250 theater company members. And we're also incubating a smaller startup called Mass Poetry that is advocating for, you know, more poetry in the schools and kids. And they have a Poetry on the T program, which is our subway, and big festival, so they're doing amazing work. So it's been a great experience, just the ability to be around everybody and to kind of share ideas and kind of find new ways to collaborate. So it's been a great experience, and I hope that they think it has been as well.
You know, I'm excited. I'd love to do a show in the future about collaborative spaces and how visual artists use them, and also, of course, you know, in talking about the range of legal issues that the Arts and Business Council covers. We're certainly trying to take a stab at covering most, or if not all, of at least the entry points for those issues in the Thriving Artist podcast. So I'm really hoping our listeners will stay tuned to upcoming episodes. But I want to ask you sort of a fun personal question. So golf, you know, you're not the first lawyer that's played golf, right? That's not too much of a surprise. But there's a book a book series many people might be familiar with called The Worst Case Scenario. And if you've heard this featured on NPR and some TV shows, How to Survive a Plane Crash, How to Survive a Night, you know, in the mountains without your coat, you know, all this other stuff. What happens if a spider bites you? How to survive that? You've co-authored a best-selling book called The Worst Case Scenario Handbook, Golf. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what drove you to do that and maybe give us an insight on why we would need to survive golf?
Well, yes, especially for those that play it. It is a survival sport in that respect. So I've been working with Quirk Books for many years, and that is their series, The Worst Case Survival Handbook series. So, and I've done a bunch of other books with other publishers, mostly like fun guidebooky type projects that I enjoy doing. So when I had the chance to work on the golf one, I jumped at it. So it is a fun book, but it's, you know, similar in that, you know, how to put out a cigar, brush fire, you know, how to tee off in front of a crowd, you know, survive a bird attack, stop a runaway cart, you know, fun. There are some actual, you know, real true how to hit balls out of water and high wind, or, you know, so it's traditional worst case survival handbook format, but it was a fun project, and I had a great time interviewing all these pros around the country that I got to interview around a different topic. So a fun project. I do a lot of work with writers and publishers, so it was fun to be on that side of the table this time. So keeps me sane.
It sounds like a fun read, you know. So for those of our listeners who have experienced or may yet experience a Hitchcockian bird attack while you're teeing off, this will tell you what to do. And it is not run. I assume it's not running away, screaming and holding your face like in the movie. But, you know, we'll see. You've been listening to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hewlings Fund for Visual Artists. For more info on the Arts and Business Council, visit artsandbusinesscouncil.org. For the Joan Mitchell Foundation and the incredibly helpful CALL Program Estate Planning Workbook for Visual Artists, check out joanmitchellfoundation.org and look for the CALL section at the bottom of the page. For more information on the Clark Hewlings Fund, visit clarkhewlingsfund.org and be sure and follow our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening, and thank you, Jim. It's really been fantastic.
Thank you.